Welcome to Amandla here on CKUT 90.3. This is a weekly African current affairs program produced both in English and in French. My name is Helden and I'm here with Gwen and Doug. So Gwen, what do we have lined up for today?
Hi, Helden. Thank you. So Doug and I had an opportunity to watch a film and then watch a panel discussion of the film. The film is called Finding Sally. It's directed by Tamara Dawit. It is about a particular period in Ethiopian history. The panel was made up of four Ethiopian women or women from the Ethiopian diaspora. It was a tremendous documentary and a really super fascinating conversation. So Doug and I are going to summarize that for you tonight.
And I, for my part, I'm still annoyed. I'm still upset. I'm still unhappy. And I'm going to talk about my unhappiness tonight.
Things. I feel a rant coming on, Helden.
Well, two things frustrated me. One is that Bill Gates produced some document and it got a huge spread in the Globe and Mail about two weekends ago. And then Matt Galloway, who I admire so much, fawned all over him for about half an hour on his morning show on CBC about how wonderful his philanthropy is and the health. He's got all the solutions to the health problems in the world. Well, in the meantime, I had a chat with the elders and folks in the village of Makupu, Malawi, and it's not such a happy place, despite Mars landings and all sorts of philanthropy from rich people. I think we still got a long way to go before this world's a good place to live.
Welcome back to Amandla on CKUT 90.3. So, Doug, what do you have lined up for us?
Well, actually, that music that you just heard is from an album of Ghanaian musicians new to the scene that was just reviewed in the New Internationals that I got this spring. And I like them because they really do my homework for me. It's a group called Alostmen, A-L-O-S-T-M-E-N, like A Lost Men. A being singular and men being plural, but they're all in one word. And they're from Ghana. And they are a very interesting mix of traditional and modern. Clearly, they're traditional. They're playing traditional instruments, including the homemade tin banjo and the old-fashioned one-string bowed lute or lyre. I'm not quite sure what name it has. But at the same time, they're in the market. They're on the ocean front. They're singing in rap and dub about modern issues and modern problems, everything from love, but also teach me and poverty. So it was fun to watch. It was very good music and a nice mix. So look them up, I Lost Men, on their YouTubes are available, and you can get the album, and that would be a good for them as well. Gwen, what happened?
Yes, well, you and I had a little movie date last week under the reality of COVID, so in our separate home, linked through Zoom. So it's a film, a documentary that came to my attention through Cinema Politica. So first I want to give a shout out to Cinema Politica because I follow them closely. They do great work. They have a whole series of films that they're making available to people during the pandemic and often followed with either panel discussion or the director is present for a Q&A. So in this instance, it was a film that had come out some time ago that had caught my eye and I had not been able to see, called Finding Sally. Very intriguing. The director is Tamara Dawit, who is an Ethiopian Canadian young woman. So there was this film and I thought, I'm going to treat Doug to this film and we're going to watch it together. So it was a film that we first watched and then we were able to attend the panel discussion, which involved Tamara Dawit, the director, as well as three other Ethiopian women or women from the Ethiopian diaspora, and that would be Eleni Santin Zeleke. She's a professor at the University of Columbia and in particular and of note, author of the book Ethiopian Theory, Revolution and Knowledge Production from 1964 to 74. There was also Rebecca Fiseha, who is a novelist and in particular of the novel Daughters of Silence, also pertaining to Ethiopia. And thirdly, it was moderated by Hannah Georges of The Atlantic. So, Doug, you got the invitation. What did you think?
Well, of course, I'm always backwards in these things. So I was all ready for the panel discussion before I realized I had to see the film. So I squeezed the film in about 2 hours before the panel. And so can we start with the film? Because must say I was extremely impressed. Impressed by particularly the dedication and determination of Tamara Dawit, who is essentially Canadian born and bred. Her father was a brother to the Sally of the title, but he left her and the family at a very young age. So she really grew up with her Canadian side as the most powerful influence, but she wanted to know Ethiopia and she stuck with it. And this whole film evolves out of her going back to Ethiopia, establishing herself there, encouraging documentary filmmaking in Ethiopia, but elsewhere as well. And so she's done, I think, a lot. And in the past, it's all been short films, but this time she did the full feature length and she's both produced and wrote the thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm very impressed with that kind of dedication and that kind of enterprise and industry. And I might say I was also impressed with the way she handled it. It wasn't her that the film was about. She really kept it on the subject of Sally and the problems that were going on in Ethiopia and the family history. And it was a family history. And of course the people involved were her aunts and her grandmother. I have a short clip that I'll play after this where she describes the fact that she had to get her grandmother's permission to do this history when she discovered at the age of 30 there was a
Yeah, Doug, let's talk about Sally for a minute, because she's the lost aunt, right, for Tamara. She's
yes.
the one that she only actually, I think, discovers that her existence when she's in Ethiopia and she sees a portrait of this or a photograph of this beautiful young woman. And she's like, who's that?
Who's that?
This is the lost aunt. This is the aunt nobody ever talked about. And that's really what ends up driving this documentary. And so it turns out that, well, a little bit of background, these aunts, their father or Tamara's grandfather was a diplomat under Haile Selassie's regime and was a diplomat to Canada. So that's the Canadian connection. That's why Tamara was born and raised in Canada. So they come from this diplomatic, very worldly family. And Sally at one point goes back to Ethiopia and, you know, up until then had been a very, very social, very, kind of a bit of, I don't want to say party girl. She was serious and engaged and all of that, but she was very kind of gregarious and out there and public. And
party, music, cosmetics, clothing. She was into the young person thing. I mean, many young people are.
And then she meets revolutionaries. She meets, in particular, one of the young leaders of it. Would it have been the EPLF, the Eritrean People's Liberation?
EPRP.
Right. And she starts spending more and more time with him and with that circle and gets absorbed into revolutionary politics in Ethiopia. And it's kind of moves on to have a very, very secret life in the guerrilla, in the realm of the guerrilla fight that was going on at the time.
Just to step back a little bit, anybody who was a diplomat under Haile Selassie was clearly connected to the family. And this was a godson. The grandfather
That's
was a
right.
godson to Haile Selassie. Mm-hmm. Life was nice for those people. They lived well. And Ottawa was the last posting where he set up the embassy for Ethiopia in Ottawa. I think it was 67 or 68, somewhere around there. Just as I was leaving from Carleton to go to Malawi. So we didn't overlap, Sally and I, but those children had a very, very nice life. It was very mm-hmm. comfortable. Mm-hmm. And so she went back to, after her studies in Carleton, as the
to student an elite
movement,
existence.
As the student movement was building yeah. against Haile Selassie. Yeah. So there was great times arriving back, meeting family, parties, the music scene in Ethiopia was amazing, club scene, but that's when the protests were on and that's where she got absorbed into
the
movement.
She gets wrapped up in that, yeah.
And just builds and builds. And then when they finally get rid of Haile Selassie, it's from the frying pan to the fire with the Derg. Mm-hmm. And things just got worse. And rather than the Derg absorbing that student movement and energy into its, because they were military people, not thinking like politicians, but as discipline, then the EPRP, among many others, was declared illegal and they were hunted down and everybody was hunted down. It was a terrible time.
And that's that dark time. That's that time of silence, the 70s and 80s, that Tamara's aunts never talked about. So it was that period of very, very deep repression. But as she comes to discover, it's also the period that an unknown aunt gets absorbed in these politics and then disappears and very evidently dies in this time. At this point, unclear as to what actually happened to her. And it's through the course of producing the documentary and traveling with her aunts that they are able to determine that she actually she got sick and she died of disease, I think. She
yes.
wasn't
oh,
able
yeah.
to be treated. She was in a very remote area, but she was very deeply loved in that area and remembered by people who were still alive and living in that area for her caregiving and compassion and involvement as a guerrilla presence in that area.
And she does it step by step and getting the aunts to dig deep into those memories. They too were surprised that she didn't know about Sally, just like the grandmother was. And grandmother,
they didn't even realize they weren't talking about her.
They had grieved her out of their system, or they had repressed the grief so that it was no longer in their system and visible. But once they got talking about it, it was clearly a tough part of their lives and a very big missing hole in their lives. And the tribute at the end, where Tamara and her partner organize a stela in the cemetery, where Sally and her partner, the revolutionary leader, were buried. I thought was very, very, very touching, and a nice summary of the effort to bring this family history together. But it's not just a family history.
It's not just family history. That's right. It's reflective of the history of the country and where it is now. And Tamara very poignantly says it was actually during the discussion forum afterwards, I think she said that ultimately you cannot drive forward without looking in the rear view mirror. And you have to talk about your history. And that is, you know, she went to great lengths to elicit and provoke and evoke memories from her aunts to the extent of she would actually physically bring them to places that would allow them to remember or confront them with something. And then they would talk about it, things they had not talked about for decades that they had repressed. And in talking about it, they were able to acknowledge not only their family history, but Ethiopia's history and this culture of silence that has enveloped the 70s and 80s in particular.
Oh yes, and the oppression of the Derg was huge, enough that if a family member had been found to be part of the enemy, then the family was part of the enemy. And one of the sisters, in fact, herself got arrested, fortunately only for a night or two or a short while. But she was taken to the torture chambers where blood splattered the walls. And she was, you know, they did that specifically to terrify these prisoners into talking. And fortunately, she was released. And remember, because Dad was was an employee or a member of the family of the Haile Selassie elite, and was recalled from Ottawa under the Derg, many people told him not to go back. But he said, I have to. And that's why his remaining family, we went back
He saw himself very much as a public servant, regardless of what regime was in place. He was very dedicated to that vision of things. There's another interesting point just to make about Tamara DeWitt's approach or methodology to her documentary is that she only spoke to women. So she spoke to the aunts. She made that a very deliberate choice because she said, men remember things differently. They form their own perspective from their own perspective, not from a community perspective. But when women remember, they tend to bring with their memories a much broader kind of community perspective. And so she, you know, very deliberately chose to focus on her aunts in trying to dig up this history and then from this personal history, tell the viewers some of the history of Ethiopia.
Absolutely, and she also ties it, or I guess it was more out of the panel, Alina in particular, who tied it to the student protests against the monarchy. Mm-hmm. Those student protests were protests about basic democracy, basic human rights, sharing, an equitable society, a whole bunch of principles that were very much from the groundswell, from the people up, because the emperor was himself, let's not be nostalgic, a very abusive ruler. And there was no parliament, there was no opposition, there was no anything but the emperor and his final word. Mm-hmm. And so the student movement set an example that is still being lived today in the youth movements that keep uprising, but are put down and put down again and again. And so it was interesting how the youth movement from as far away and as long ago as the late 60s, early 70s, still reflects itself in some of the political opposition we see today. What about the panelists, Gwen? What was your feeling on the discussion?
Yeah, well, I mean, like you, Doug, I think the person who riveted me the most and I found most sort of fascinating and insightful was Eleni Sentim-Zeleke. That's, as I said, the professor from Columbia University and author of the book Ethiopian Theory, revolution and knowledge production. She was really, really fascinating. Also, I mean, really the whole conversation was about, is about history, you know, whether it's from the personal to the broader, the personal is the political. That's very clear in the story of Tamara DeWitt's family. This talking about the repression of history, the silence, the level of trauma that Ethiopians live with that also has served as a silencing factor. Actually, I think it was the author, Rebecca Piseha, who really yes. talked about the deep, deep silence in her family.
The grief and the trauma that comes from that, that forces the silence on, you know.
And then, but then Eleni's saying, but you need to listen to silence because silence has its own story too. It's important to acknowledge and recognize the silence and where does it come from. And I really found her very, very interesting, and talking about the mythology of Ethiopian history, that it's this very epochal, these great moments in history followed by tragedy, followed by great moments, followed by tragedy, that there's a mythologization of Ethiopian history that's kind of particular to Ethiopia. You know, they were the ones who thwarted the Italians and were never colonized. So that was a big high moment. The emperor, a high moment. Then, you know, these very deep, dark, tragic moments. But then they move out again into these great moments. And so she kind of wants to take apart a little bit that rhythm of that storytelling of that, you know, the Ethiopian arc of history. What about you, Doug?
Well, I'm of course politically oriented, so I was fascinated by Elena Sentim Zeleki as the theoretician who yeah. had the political overview, a very left Marxist feminist, much into, and it was good as well that she was there, because she brought a layering of the personal with the larger picture. I thought that was very important, where Rebecca was much more of the Tamara, coming out of the personal, coming out of the feelings and the lived reality of the horror and the trauma and all of that. Mm-hmm. And the very effective, as you say, Rebecca, when she got going, was eloquent in what she'd get on. And I really, I won't repeat what you said, but it was true. She did the mythology of things and how we create these myths. And actually, the little piece I've got from Africa is a Country, for the interview with Elena, deals a bit with that, because she goes back to the origins of the monarchy and how, in fact, it was claimed to be Africa's only truly independent country, never colonized. But in fact, the regime that was installed was in its own way a colonial regime, trying to bring together disparate peoples and extending its borders into Sudan and up to Egypt and so on, back in the 1880s and 90s and so on, when colonialism was a white force. There were still empires in Africa that were establishing their territory.
Eleni also, you know, really placed a lot of emphasis on class, land, ethnicity. She said, you know, you want to understand Ethiopia, we need to look at land, we need to look at class, we need to look at ethnicity, and in an honest way, and try to move away again from these glory peaks and tragedies and glory, but really kind of get in there on the ground and be more analytical and less yes. mythological about its history.
The monarchy was a feudal monarchy, and aristocrats ran the place, and people were displaced from their lands. Yes, exactly. So it was I found it interesting in so many ways, and yet at the same time, it wasn't the kind of politics that we think of when we think of cinema politica. It was a much more personal historical perspective, and apart from Elena giving it the more theoretical, contextual, and hard political line, everybody else came at it from a very out of the human and yeah. into the personal, and then
I would not say it was a particularly analytical film.
No, the film itself, no, it's no. It's revelatory, great scenes from the past, amazing clips. Even just the aunties looking at the photographs and telling the stories about what was going on around them is great oral history. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful that it's been done and needs to be done to keep that history alive.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've covered that.
I think so. So the name of the film is Finding Sally, and you can find it. It's available, I think, now for purchase, no longer free streaming, but it is available online for anybody who would be interested in giving it a go.
Highly recommended. Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you. I so appreciate you making time for this conversation. And I don't like to, you know, I'm not one of those people who likes to read the person's bio, because I'm like, why am I reading your bio? You can tell your story better than I can. So why don't you start by introducing who you are and what you do?
Yeah. So my name is Tamara Mariam Dawit. I'm a Ethiopian Canadian, and I've worked across a lot of art form. So I started in the music industry. I worked with spoken word poets in theater and dance. And then really primarily for the last 10 years, I've just been working in film, both as a director and producer. And for me, you know, regardless of what the art format is, they've all been opportunities for me to tell stories. And generally in my artistic practice, I try and focus on the stories of women and the stories of voices from Eastern Africa.
Where did that love of story come from?
I think reading. I mean, I grew up from a very young age with my mother reading to me, and that tradition of, you know, reading. And I think for most of my life, I've been reading as a child, you know, probably a few books a week. And as an adult, maybe like a novel a month or one or two. So I think consuming content, story content, whether it's books or podcasts or films, has always been an important part of my schedule.
So you said you referenced that you love telling stories. You love particularly the stories of women and East African women. Why East Africa?
Because my family is Ethiopian. So I feel like the narrative that most people have outside of Ethiopia about Ethiopia is one of two things. It's one, information about famine, because of it's sort of the negative stain left by this band-aid fundraising activism in the 1980s, or the other information I find a lot of people have in the Black, Caribbean, and African community is about the emperor, and the emperor was, you know, so wonderful and all these great things he did as an African leader. But I think, you know, both of those only give you a very small portion of the country. So I'm really interested in helping other aspects of history and other points of views be told internationally.
So you specifically said that you love film. What is it about film that drew you? Why film? Because there are many mediums that you could use for storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, I think I got into film because I was working in international development, and a thing called YouTube was invented or launched, and suddenly it was going to be easier for us as an organization to put video content explaining our work online. And one of the things that I realized, you know, very quickly in doing communications, that the sort of old format of corporate videos with talking heads saying like, our work is so good because of this, isn't interesting and no one wants to watch that. But we can actually take some of the stories that were traditionally told by NGOs through articles and case studies, and those can be made into films. And it's much more interesting. There's a stronger connection, and it's more engaging for people to be able to see live in action through a video the issue or the person you're trying to introduce them to. So that for me was really how I got into filmmaking. And I think, you know, to this day, when I look at a topic that I want to produce content on, I really look at it from the angle of what is the best format for this piece of content to reach the most people or to reach the audience that I want to reach.
So you talked about using film as a medium to introduce someone, introduce people to someone. You've just, or your most recent film that has done phenomenally well is playing at all these major festivals, is one that is very personal. Can you tell me about that film and why you made it?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a film I was expecting to make. Even when I found out that I had this aunt that no one talked about, I was sort of focused on a separate project, but I was really intrigued to try and unpack like why and how could there be a member of the family that no one had spoken about and thus I didn't know about. Why has this happened? I realized that this is something that's affecting a much sort of broader cross-section of Ethiopian society, this idea of collective silence. So I wanted to make this film to sort of dig into that and then also use it as an opportunity to explain to people both in Ethiopia, younger populations here and internationally, about what happened in the 1970s and why the emperor was actually overthrown and about the injustices under the dictatorship that took over after him.
And why was it? Like, what did you find out in the making of this film about why there was this silence in your family, why you didn't know you had this aunt?
I mean, I think there's two sides to that. There's one, I think it's important to realize that during the military dictatorship, it was illegal and dangerous to mourn someone who had passed away because they were opposing the government. That would mean that you too could be seen as someone who was opposing the government, which would be dangerous. And these were not people who you should be honoring. So that's also why my family and many families, like, you wouldn't tell someone that their relative had passed away because they would immediately want to enter into this large mourning and funeral production, which would be dangerous. So I think when you're told you're not allowed to do something, then it just becomes habit. And I don't think that my family was purposefully hiding her. I think it just became a habit to not talk about her. Plus, it was painful. So when things are painful, you can also try and suppress them.
What surprised you in the making of this film? Like, was there anything that you found out about your aunt, who she was, that surprised you about her?
I mean, I think that the initial information I got about Sally was from the perspective of my aunts. And I realized very quickly that they really only had a small sliver of the picture. And they really only new information that people had told them. They hadn't perhaps pushed, and they had not maybe have been, you know, they hadn't done their own investigation to this extent because it was going to be difficult for them to do it. So I was better positioned to do that. And I think my aunts really saw Sally as someone who, you know, worked as a nurse and was sort of doing these like things you assume women do in the time of war. And she was also involved in political ideology. But for me, going through and doing this project, I found out that, well, yes, she did those things, but she was also involved in what, you know, the government at that time would consider terrorism in terms of bombing and assassination attempts. She received military training. She had a gun with her when she was going underground. And that, you know, the involvement was, to me, much deeper and much more dangerous than how my aunts had perhaps painted the picture.
And what's your family's response been to, first of all, you finding out all this information that maybe they didn't know? And then second of all, you putting this effectively out into the world for all of us to see and to know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, when I first started poking around and asking questions about Sally, one of the first people I talked to was my grandmother. And my grandmother, it had never occurred to her that I didn't know. And then she sort of digested that information and came back to me and said, you know, if you don't know about this, it means that other people in our family and other young people here probably don't know about the values, the vision, and the sacrifice that Sally and other young people made in the 1970s. And that's wrong, because if we don't know about our past, we can't learn from it. And we can't also be inspired to effect similar change today. So that was sort of the directive that came from my grandmother that sort of, I think, pushed everyone to participate because she had said, you know, we need to do this to remember her.
We are joined by Eleni Sentim-Zeleke, who is an assistant professor, as Will said earlier, at the Middle Eastern, I'm going to mess up their long name, MESAS at Columbia University. And she's also the author of this great book now called Ethiopia in Theory, Revolution and Knowledge Production, 1964 to 2016. And I think she's about to come on. There she is.
How are you?
I'm great. I'm doing great. But I'm happy that you came on the program. This is really wonderful. So I'm happy that you're here today.
Thank you for coercing me to come on.
You're giving away some of my secrets to the world that I'm like very persistent, right?
You were very persistent, but I'm glad to be here.
It became like a math game. We won't get it to like 50, 75. 75 is better than, So, I mean, we want you to help us understand like the world of the state. We sort of, Ethiopia is there, it's in the back, it's hovering there. And I think it might be useful to also at some point, and to use Ethiopia as a way to like argue about these things. So, but to open the discussion and to like set us up, what do you mean when you say the crisis of the African state?
Sure. So what I'm trying to make an argument about Ethiopia is that so much of the conversation about the Ethiopian crisis right now has focused on all of these really internal dynamics. And I think that in order to understand what's going on in Ethiopia, we need to have a theory of the African state, and we need to understand sort of what the problem of the African state is. And I suppose the person that I'm really turning to when I think about the crisis of the African state is Mahmoud Mamdani, who in his book, Citizen and Subject, tries to produce a theory of African politics. And he really tries to ground that theory of African politics within an African experience. And he makes the argument that we shouldn't do we should study Africa through analogy, that we need to really think about, you know, the dynamics of the African state and its particularities. So one of the things that I think Mamdani argues is that the African state is constantly sort of flip-flopping between a form of decentralized despotism and centralized authoritarianism, right? And he links this problem to the post-colonial state, arguing that the post-colonial state is in fact inherited from the colonial state, right? And that the colonial state was governed the way the colonial state operated was that it governed rural areas of Africa through customary law and ethnic polities, while statutory law was reserved for city dwellers. And so, according to Mamdani, the African post-colonial state has been deracialized. The African post-colonial state has deracialized the city, but has failed to sort of establish institutions that link the rural and the urban in a fair, equitable manner. So we can characterize the city as a middle-class entity that is, it's largely disconnected from rural reality in Africa. And I think this is important to think about because rural populations in many parts of Africa, constitute a large percentage of the population. In a place like Ethiopia, something like 80% of the population remains rural. And of that 80% of the rural population, 75% are still engaged in smallholder agriculture, right? So it's a very particular social setting and political economy in Africa and in Ethiopia in particular, right? So part of what Mamdani is arguing is that the crisis of the post-colonial state and the question of democracy is a question of how to reform indirect rule, right? This system of governing the rural areas through customary law and through ethnic polities, right? And I suppose one of the things that he says is that post-colonial politics is characterized by an attempt to either reform indirect rule through establishing a modernizing centralized authority, but then this provokes a reaction from the rural areas, and then what we see is a kind of return to decentralized despotism. And that's the sort of flip-flop that he's talking about in terms of the crisis of the African states, going between the decentralized despotism and this centralized authoritarianism. I suppose, you know, many people might argue, like, well, what does this have to do with Ethiopia? Because Ethiopia was never colonized. And, you know, there's a unique set of circumstances in Ethiopia that needs to be theorized. Mamdani does include Ethiopia within this African experience, trying to talk about. Yeah, he does. He talks about the Derg quite a bit in his book. And I would argue that even though Ethiopia was never formally colonized, the form of the state that was adopted, particularly after the Battle of Adowa in 1896. The Battle of Adowa, as many of you might know, is that battle between Menelik and the Italians that really establishes Ethiopia as a kind of sovereign state, right? And I would say the form of the state that is adopted after 1896 brings all of the problems that Mamdani identifies with the post-colonial state to Ethiopia very early on, right? So this idea of what is the relationship between local traders and international markets, how to incorporate different language groups under one political authority, et cetera. Those are questions that the colonial state is grappling with, the post-colonial state is grappling with, and it is the question that the Ethiopian state has to grapple with in terms of, you know, defining itself as a territorial sovereign with boundaries that are fixed and that are recognized by an international world, right? So the scramble for Africa, I would say, is defining the state form in Africa, even in a place like Ethiopia. And so, you know, even as early as 1876, we have somebody like Yohannes, who is one of the sort of well-known king leader of northern Ethiopia, and we see him in Massoa, which is a port town in Eritrea, and he's with the French council there, and he's hanging out with the French council, and he's, you know, he's aware of the scramble for Africa, and he's saying to the French council, please help us define our territorial boundaries in relation to Egypt, actually, right? And what is also interesting is that Yohannes is killed by the Mahdists in Sudan, right? And the Mahdist state is a response to Egypt colonizing Sudan, right? And so, and the Mahdist state is responding to Egyptian incursion in Sudan, but is also involved in its own project of expanding territory and establishing boundaries, right? So we have all of these multiple indigenous African states taking on the scramble for Africa and having to define its boundaries in ways that resemble the European nation state, right? And I think that that's crucial in terms of understanding some of the conundrums that are with us in Ethiopia today. A lot of people want to talk about the Ethiopian state as having this long legacy from Aksum to, you know, to Addis Ababa today. And you know, of course, there are state traditions in Africa all over the place. There's nothing unique about Ethiopia. State traditions have existed from Mali to, I don't know, everywhere, right? So, but we would never make the claim that, you know, the Djenne state is, you know, the same as the Mali state of today, right? Because we understand that there's all these moments of discontinuity, even if there's also moments of continuity that connect Djenne to the contemporary Mali state, right? So I don't want to deny that there are state traditions in the Horn of Africa that have continuity with the present, but there's all these moments of discontinuity that need to be theorized, right? And so how does the scramble for Africa, in a sense, reshape what the nation state is in Ethiopia, or what the state is, right? Because I think prior to the scramble for Africa, this notion of territorially bounded nation states is not really a thing that existed. We have a sense of sovereignty with overlapping boundaries, and with people moving in and out of those overlapping boundaries, you know, freely. So there's something that's happening in the late 19th century in Ethiopia that means that it needs to think of itself as having a kind of homogenous population within its territory. And that means that it is, you know, dealing with, it has a problem of plurality. How do you deal with all of these, you know, 80 something language groups that actually exist within the boundaries of Ethiopia? How do you deal with the ways in which, you know, people are relating to different markets? How do you regulate that? I mean, you know, what is the role of the state anyways? The role of the state in many ways is to provide transportation and communication, you know, infrastructures so as to connect the local to the international. And it's there to build a bureaucracy and a military and a police in order to control the movement of people and to interface the local with the international, right?
To hunt meat is better than you then teach me how to chop meat. I'll be the wrong way. Teach me how to get cash is better than you then teach me how to chew cash. I'll be the wrong way. You then teach me how to chew fish every day.
Who's not impressed with the fact that after spending $2.7 billion, the U.S. has managed to land a craft on the surface of Mars some 56 millions of miles away, and the plan is for 10 years from now to spend a large amount of money to recuperate the materials collected by the rover and bring them back to Earth so that we can study the origins of the universe. I am also not impressed that rich capitalist oligarchs can spend $55 million each to fly into space and spend a few days at the International Space Station. Why am I so negative about these ultra expensive technologies for rich people's egoism? Well, last Saturday, I spoke with the family elders and some young people in Makupu village on Saturday morning. Makupu is in the central region of Malawi, less than 90 minutes from the capital city of Lilongwe and a mere 12,457 kilometers from Montreal, and 55,987,543 kilometers closer than Mars and much cheaper to get to. The conversation was sparked by the concerns of friends and family here in Montreal who were worried about the health and preparedness of the Makupu villages to deal with the coronavirus. We had news that the South African variant was moving relentlessly across the continent and attacking Malawi on its way. They said they'd been given buckets for wash stations and two bars of soap in March 2020 when the pandemic alert first came in. But the villagers told us 1 year later, the plastic buckets had all broken, and of course the soap was long gone. I asked about the health of the family groups in the village, and they sidestepped the question and replied that everyone was basically okay. No one had had the coronavirus, but that they were all somewhat weakened because they were hungry. The crops that had been harvested in April, May at the end of the rains in 2020 were long gone. With the pandemic lockdowns and closures, they had been unable to make any money, even doing piecework, and now they were without food or the resources to buy anything. 2.7 billion to land on Mars with a sophistication that defies belief, and we can't feed a large percentage of the population here on this orb we share as a species. I am not impressed. Space flights to Mars versus feeding people are choices made here on Earth by ruling classes who establish what is more important than human life. It is a system they have created to accumulate wealth, power, and status. The rulers of the United States, for instance, have made it very clear that they and their class partners consider it more important to keep the economy going so they can make obscene profits than the lives of 500,000 U.S. citizens who have died to COVID. Bill Gates, for instance, added $130 billion to his fortune in 2020 alone. It is therefore systemic that wealth flows to them and is premised on the exploitation and cheap labor of Africans and people of color throughout the colonized world. It extends to exploiting working classes in the rich countries, regardless of their colors. It is systemic because it uses its wealth and power to capture state control and thereby shape policy and militarily enforce its control over every corner of the world. And the wealth flows untrammeled to the world's richest oligarchs, while Makupu villagers and millions more like them are denied access to clean water, adequate food, basic health services, and suffer the negative consequences of environmental degradation created by the rapacious system the oligarchs have created. Are you old enough to remember the response of the U.S. military-industrial profiteers to the death of 3,000 people on September 11th, 2001? Let me remind you. They declared a war on terror, created a Department of Homeland Security, one of the largest and best-financed departments of the federal government, passed the Patriot Act to curtail personal freedoms, declared war in Afghanistan and Iraq, to which more than 1.5 million U.S. soldiers have been sent, and they spent $6.4 trillion between 2001 and 2019 to ensure that never again would 3,000 U.S. citizens lose their lives to terrorist incidents. And the profits, the heaven-ordained profits made by the U.S. military and its corporate trough feeders, are what have kept a decrepit U.S. economy alive. The country lives off war and lives for war. Now the same profiteers have happily invested $2.7 billion to land their gadgets on Mars, and at the same time, the people of Makupu, the people of Malawi, and much of Africa, and large sectors of the world's population, including here in Canada, are hungry. They lack access to food, a basic human right not covered, unfortunately, by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. This, my dear friends and comrades, is not a civilized society. How can anyone look at that callous and barbaric loss of 500,000 U.S. citizen lives to COVID and consider it civilized that the rich and power-hungry running their society would happily play with its technology and space travel rather than healing its people. These are choices made by the rulers. These rulers are bad. Dare I use the word evil? People, if these are their priorities. Why can any individual spend $55 million to fly into space as a lark when 15 million Malawians walk the borderline of hunger for 6 months every year? Back to Bill Gates and the $130 billion in increased wealth in 2020 during a devastating pandemic in which millions lost their livelihoods. Can anyone tell me why a man who has profited by monopolistically cornering the market, avoiding paying taxes like a religion, and forcing competitors off the scene, makes such obscene profits, and then be given a four-page spread in the Globe and Mail two Saturdays ago, and almost an hour on the CBC's primetime morning show, The Current, to tell us how to solve the world's problem, which he and his oligarch friends are the major cause of the misery over which they rule. The Globe and Mail writers and CBC's Matt Galloway fawned over Bill Gates' generosity and his pronouncements because he's a philanthropist, giving away so much of his fortune. Did I say he added $130 billion to his wealth in a year when millions are suffering unemployment and evictions, and worse still, unaffordable health costs because a universal health care plan would be socialistic and might mean the people would require the oligarchs to pay back to society some of what they've extorted out of it? Philanthropists, horse feathers, as my dad used to say. Piss artists, I say. Thank you. That's it for tonight. Good night.
Have it, Amanda listeners. My name is Helden. I've been discussing with Gwen and Doug, and stay tuned to Jazz Euphorium.
Ah, la belle. you want.